I want you to develop your skills at observing what actually happens. I want you to take a lot of specific notes about what you see. And I'm going to talk a little more about how to take some of these notes. When I go and observe discussions, I put 3 or 4 pieces of paper in front of me, and I'm usually able to fill all of them, sometimes both sides of the page, even in half an hour or 40 minutes. I mean, there's so much happening in a discussion that you can write down. One way to do that is simply to keep a log of the times. You know, put down 8:05 and 8:07, 8:08, and what actually is being said, what the teacher says, what students are saying, to write down verbatim what's actually happening. That's very powerful and useful. You can also, by the way, record discussions with a tape recorder and then go back to that, or videotape discussions. And I've done, when I was a classroom teacher, I did a lot of videotapes of myself leading discussions, and it was extremely helpful to analyze those tapes. I want to now show you a website I've made to help you analyze discussions. And what it does is it shows 49 plus ways to gather data about a discussion. All right, as we talk about this, we'll also be able to pick up on some of the details about what makes for a good discussion, which will draw on our previous discussion and also give you some more things to look for and some more things to think about as a discussion leader. I want you to become very experienced observers. Your skills of observing a discussion will be very important to yourself as a teacher, but also you can work with your colleagues to observe discussions, and you can involve your students in observing you. And I will talk a little bit about how I had some of my students use some of these very same tools I'm talking to you about to keep track of things happening in the class and share that information with me. Part of making myself that reflective practitioner that we always talk about. We've talked about the organization of students and the seating and position of the teacher, something that I'm very hypersensitive to. What you can do is draw maps. Take a full piece of paper, draw a map of where everybody is. And if you were to draw maps showing their desks as big squares, for example, you could then take notes on top of those squares about what's happening. And you can make up your own code for how to do that. For example, every time a student volunteers raises their hand and is called on, you could then put a V down, meaning volunteer. Or every time a teacher calls a student that does not have their hand up, that might be a non-volunteer. Or you could have, if the teacher doesn't call on them and they say something anyway, that could be a call-out answer. You could call that a C or a CO. You can also clue these desks as to gender, and you can make your speculation about people's ethnic background, but I do point out to you that you can't know people's ethnic background just by the way they look. Because very often there's a lot more to that than meets the eye. But you can still, you can record that, and knowing that it's unreliable information. Nonetheless, it can still help you in the end try to do some examination of what's happening. Is only the right-hand side of the room participating? Why is that? Are only the male students or the female students? And you can do actual math. You got X number of male students, X number of female students, Y number of female students. You had 225 contributions over the course of the discussion. What percentage was which group, and so forth. You can do some math on it, and you can get some very interesting results that you can try to figure out whether they're meaningful or not. We've talked about the importance in observing a discussion of actually drawing maps and recording specific data. You can also have up here the classroom environment. You can take notes about what it looks like, how inviting it is, and we've talked a little about that before. One of the things that happens at the beginning of discussion, presumably, is setting up a clear purpose for the discussion. You can see today the things that I was doing to try to make that happen. The teacher can make a goal statement. Here's what I hope we're going to learn today. Here's what we're going to talk about. The teacher can also do things during the course of the discussion to set up its purposes, such as make benchmark comments like, so we've been saying this so far, but what about saying this? Or what about going in this direction? Let's also talk about that. Or you've raised a very important question here. Let's talk about that. Or what does everyone think about Ashley's question, for example, or Ashley's topic? So there's ways in which the teacher can create benchmark comments, links within the discussion, mini summaries of the discussion, links to previous learning, like this brings us back to what we've been talking about so far the last 2 weeks as we looked at the characters and their role and their relationships in Hamlet. Of course, you can also the teacher can make closing statements, and as you observe discussions, it'll be very interesting to write down precisely how the teacher is doing that. Another important point that we talked about, I think Beth was emphasizing, the idea of the teacher's enthusiasm, and how do you actually know that you're being enthusiastic or not? And that's why it's, by the way, very interesting to look at a videotape of yourself. Sometimes it's disturbing. Well, I used to videotape not only myself but the class discussion, and sometimes I would show portions of that videotape to the class and let the class sit around and talk about how can we make this a better discussion. And when there were problems going on, sometimes that was more effective than for me to say to the class, here's a problem that I see, but ask them to see what the problem was. And by the way, if you show teenagers videotapes of themselves, you better figure to keep it short, and the first time you show it, they're only going to look at themselves and their hairdo. But then say, okay, look at yourself, watch yourself. Okay, we're going to watch this for 5 minutes. Now let's do it again, watch it for 5 more minutes, and now I want you to look at what I want you to look at. And so you can keep track of the teacher's statements. What is the teacher saying that demonstrates caring, affect, interest, or enthusiasm? What is the teacher actually doing with their hand motions or their movements around the class to demonstrate that? There's so many things that are important to a discussion that we will call that I'll call discussion support activities. In your observations, you can pay attention to that. We talked today about writing. Jeff Wilhelm will talk about using drawing in the course of a discussion. Of course, today you do the writing before the discussion, but it's also possible to stop a discussion in the middle of the discussion and say, I'm really intrigued by Kristen's point. Let's everyone write now some thoughts about what Kristen said. Building writing into the discussion is a very good way to enhance the participation of the students. And then we've also talked about small groups. The small groups can happen before the discussion. You do the writing, you do a small group, you can do a group of two, a dyad, then you can do a larger group, and then you could go to the whole group. That will really help prepare people to participate. You can also, of course, break it in the middle and say, if you got a stopping point, nothing's happening, let's go into two groups of two or three and talk about it and then bring it back. The issue of note-taking is important. Having students, are the students taking notes? Are they invited to take notes? It's another thing that you can record when you're looking at a discussion. If you're looking at text, how reading is utilized in the course of that discussion, you may want to pay attention to as well. Using the blackboard or the overhead during a discussion is very, very powerful. It sends a really clear message that what you write up there is important. And I like using it because it emphasizes things, and if you want to emphasize things, it's very effective. But I'm also very thoughtful about it. I'm sometimes reluctant to do it because it's a very powerful. You can actually have students write on the blackboard or the whiteboard instead of you doing it. And that's another way to make things happen. If you're having students make lists or they might work in small groups and then share their stuff on big pieces of paper or on the blackboard and they go and write it around, that's another way to make it less teacher-centered if you want to. I'm not against doing it. I just want you to realize the power of it and utilize it carefully and in context. And the importance of integrating the homework in. We began to talk a little before about how you make sure students do their homework. One of the key rules is to make sure that they actually use the homework in class. There's something that they're going to do with the homework that's important. And so then they know they'll learn the lesson that they need to have their homework in class. If they don't have it done, they won't be able to participate. And so you can build that into the discussion. By the way, metacognition is a really good thing to do with a discussion. And maybe you're familiar with that word. That's the idea of talking about thinking, talking about the process of what you're doing. So you can say, okay, right now I'd like us to stop for a few minutes and talk about how you all think the discussion went. What did you like about the way we held our discussion? You're talking about some topic. Now let's turn to talking about the discussion itself. And that will be very helpful. You can also have students write. I would say, I'd like everyone to take right now a couple minutes, write down some comments about how you feel the class is going or about how you feel I'm doing the discussion or about the discussion itself. I would gather those, not have them sign their name on it. I would read them aloud, and that would be a very powerful way to valorize their thinking and their participation and then get their thinking, and that helps them become owners of the discussion. You're talking, you're seeing some of the strategies I'm using over the course of those months as I build them up into becoming better and better discussion participants. One of the things that's crucial to discussion, as you guys have been mentioning, is the questions that you ask. Higher order questions. And I think that's a really important part of the questioning business. But there's a lot more to questioning than simply whether or not it's high order or not. For example, the number of questions. I put one question on the board, and I tried to stick to that. I had a very rich, complex question, I hope. And that, I think, is a very good way to do have a better discussion. Sometimes you go into a class, they'll have 30 questions very fast. Now, that isn't necessarily bad. You have to think about carefully what's happening and look at who participates and what the goal of the discussion is, for heaven's sake. But be very aware of how many questions the teacher asks. Be very aware of how clear they are. That's why it's important to write them down. The intellectual level, you can use Bloom's taxonomy to code that. And then repeating questions. And there's a lot of risks if the teacher asks a question and then continually repeats it, it can train the students not to listen to the teacher. Okay, so you learn the value of asking the question only once. And the other thing that's really interesting that happens a lot in discussions is where the teacher repeats the student answers. And when the teacher starts doing that, the teacher thinks in their own mind, hey, I'm valorizing the students. I'm saying back what they said, or I'm condensing what they said and making it even better. They're going to feel really good because I valorize them by saying that. But you know what that does? Has an unintended consequence, which is by repeating student answers, you train the students to not listen to each other. They learn that what's only important are the words, the pearls that drop out of the teacher's mouth. But I think you want to be very careful about that. You want to learn to help students learn to listen to each other rather than to you. And so you might, rather than repeating them, you might say, what that student Rochelle just said is really an important idea. And then someone else said, what did she say? Don't repeat it yourself. Ask Beth to say, well, what was it that Rochelle just said? You know, who can tell us what Rochelle said? Who can elaborate on what Rochelle said? That takes it away from you being the total source of the knowledge and information discussion. Runs the risk over time of killing the discussion. We've talked about wait time. I would say that to practice as a teacher to count. When you're the teacher, the pressure is on you. You feel 5 seconds seems like a long time, but count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 in your head to create that wait time. And of course, as soon as the wait time stops, the thinking on your question stops and the starting to think about what other people are saying. If you think your question is worth it and important, you want to enhance that wait time. And one way, of course, to do that is the integration of writing, as we've been talking about. Volunteers versus non-volunteers. Very big question, controversial topic. I believe it's extremely important to call on non-volunteers. And let me put another way, to invite them to participate. I don't mean to call on them to embarrass them. What happens so readily is that you move from that invitation and someone, you know, having to be sort of pulled a little bit in, to pretty soon they start volunteering. And if you want to get in the habit of inviting people. Now, you noticed I did one little invitation, which was to say, there's some of you we haven't heard from yet, let's hear from you. That's one way to invite. We haven't heard from any of the guys in this class. We haven't heard from people sitting on the left-hand side of the room. We haven't heard from this group of three over here. Let's hear from you. That's a great way to do it that doesn't pick on people. But you can also ask individual people sometimes. I really loved the story that Ashley told us about how the teacher brought the reluctant students after school to talk in a literature circle. I think those students are going to be more ready to participate during the next class meetings. That's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Notice what happens if I say, what's the capital of South Dakota? Or if I say, Heidi, what's the capital of North Dakota? If I name the student first, then everybody's off the hook and they stop thinking. And Heidi's on the spot. But if I don't name the student first, then everybody worries about the question and tries to try to come up with an answer. So it's really important not to name the students before you ask the question and before you create that wait time. You may want to keep track of how the professors you're observing are doing that or not doing that. Notice that you can also keep track of the pattern of responses. As a teacher says something, student says something, teacher says something, student says something, TS, 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 TS. Or as a teacher asks a question, student, 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 student. Or even student asks a question, student, student, student. So you can keep track of that pattern. That pattern can be very revealing and interesting. The issue of probing. Natasha has just said something that's very interesting. I want to help her develop a response. I might ask her another question. Do I name her first, or then do I help probe with that? That's a teaching strategy you can utilize. It can take you to a higher level of thinking. It can enhance someone's participation. It can also make it very teacher-centered and focus on the teacher and the teacher's previous ideas. So all of these different strategies have their advantages and their disadvantages, and what you want to do, and there's no one that's just, there's no silver bullet or perfect way to do it, but you want to know these different issues and think about these different strategies in a complex way so you can make very careful decisions as you're trying to lead the discussion. And of course, you can time how much the students talk and the teacher talks. I think that's a very rich information. Is the teacher constantly saying things like, you're right, okay, good idea? You want to be encouraging like that, but notice what that does again. That again says the teacher is the final arbiter of what's right or wrong. And then students are very responsive to that. If the teacher says, excellent idea, Brandon, well, Brandon gets his little halo, and that kind of reduces other people's willingness to participate. Ironically, you're rewarding students with a warm fuzzy, as we used to say, but that can kind of turn other students down from talk. So be very careful and thoughtful about how you use praise and certainly censure, as we've already pointed out, as Justin and others mentioned before, that can really undermine a discussion very quickly. Distributing of the questions we've talked about, the issue of responses and gender and background and social class and all the other things that impact people's willingness to participate is something else you can keep track of to a certain extent when you're observing a discussion. You can watch the students. You want to watch the teacher and the students both. You want to be transcribing the students and the teacher's comments and looking at how frequently the students are participating. I talked about that map a little while ago. I've talked about the length of their responses. You can count 1,000, 2,000, get a sense for how long the student responses are. Write that information down. You can try to record whether or not the students are talking to each other or talking to the teacher, whether the students ever ask questions of themselves, of the teacher. If they're connecting it to things they did before, they connect it to their own experience, which is this idea of reader response. We'll be talking more about that. We've talked about the intellectual level of questions and transcribing that level and transcribing those questions, trying to record the level, how the balance of the topic works out over the course of a discussion. You want to assess how the students are learning from the discussion as you're leading it. And so you listen to what they're saying when you're the teacher. You pay attention to how that level is going. You can do things like, how many of you think that you agree with Alice, or whatever, and everybody raises their hand. Or you can do fingers to fists of five. We've done that here a couple of times. On a scale of 1 to 5, what's your position on this issue? That monitoring of student involvement and thinking is a very important part of the discussion. And let me just kind of wrap up here with a few last comments. You can do some things where you're watching whether the students are on task. Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? Every 3 minutes, you can do a time on task analysis that you know this, the teacher's assigned a certain thing. You can see, are the students actually doing that? You can look at their involvement. You can consider the tone of the teacher in terms of what kind of discussion management that they're creating. Whether they're calling on students because they want to know the answer, or they're calling on students because they want to manage, they want them to pay attention. Like, Justin, you're not listening right now, I'm going to call on you. That's a very powerful discussion managing strategy that I think undermines ultimately the value of the conversation itself. I think it's much more effective to say, I need everyone to participate. We want all of you guys paying attention right now. Even if you see only one or two people not paying attention, that general statement can really draw them in. Those are some specific ways to gather data, and there are some very rich ways too, such as questionnaires, interviewing teachers and students in depth, doing ethnographies of a classroom activity. There's a lot of really rich, in-depth ways. I'm looking for you to begin at the stage of gathering objective data and to use some of that data in your analysis of a discussion so you will become a better observer of discussion and obviously a better leader of discussion.